You probably noticed from Engdahl's article that no matter which party was in office, the financial elites set U.S. policy. And you've probably also noticed that in the present election cycle, that some candidates in both parties, who evidently are not considered down with the program, are excluded from media coverage or are ridiculed and dismissed as unelectable, pre-screened before the voting even happens. I agree with Richard Moore's implication in last week's reading that the two parties are basically run against us as good cop, bad cop, exchanged for one another when things go off the rails, when deniability and strategy change is desired, or when it looks like people are getting mad and waking up. And that's also why impeachment is off the table. The leadership of both parties are complicit in all of the crimes committed in the interest of Rockefeller et al. The final speaker of the show will address the question of democracy versus corporate rule. He's a former presidential candidate himself, though most Americans probably have never heard of him. He's David Cobb, a public interest lawyer from Texas who ran as the Green Party presidential candidate in 2004. Here in the Northeast, especially, there are many small towns and cities that for generations relied for livelihood on a factory, a mill, or a mine, something like that. The corporate owners of the facility decided to offshore them to increase their profits. People in the town were stripped of their livelihood, not only the former employees, but all of the other people whose livelihood depended on the factory workers' income in exchange for their goods and services. What does it mean to have a democracy if you can't decide your economic fate, your ability to obtain the necessities of life? If voting can't address the way you live, what is it for? Why don't the factory workers, in my example, or the townspeople in general, have anything to say about the fate of the factory they depend on? If you can't keep what you want to keep, or conversely reject what you don't want to have, then you don't have a vote on deciding what really matters. Who is keeping your right to decide these things from you? And why do we put up with it? Why have a few scam artists on Wall Street been able to command the power to destroy the livelihoods of millions of people who have never even heard of a collateralized mortgage obligation? Or for that matter, to extinguish life on the planet in order to drink $10,000 martinis? These are real questions that need answers. Here's David Cobb speaking at the 2006 Green Institute Conference in Washington, D.C., but especially timely right now.
I want to point out the major topics that we'll be covering today through the course of this workshop and this initial presentation. First and foremost, the whole concept of public versus private. Secondly, intimately connected to the conversation will be the concept of sovereignty, which is who rules, who's in charge. We'll also talk about legal personhood. And you'll notice that personhood is in quotations because personhood is a very specific idea under law. It basically means if you are a person under law, that you have the ability to assert rights that the state will acknowledge and defend if necessary. Next, we'll talk about corporate charters to begin the conversation about just what the heck a corporation is. Then we'll also talk about the difference between defining versus regulating. By that I mean, are we really defining our society? Are we defining our institutions? Are we really in charge? Or are we merely trying to regulate at the margins the fundamental core issues? And then, of course, the topic, democracy. Because I will say with all candor, with absolute sincerity, I want to be part of a nonviolent revolution for democracy in the United States of America. And I think it's important for us to recognize that the United States, quite frankly, is coming rather late to the democracy movement. Now, at least the modern democracy movement, because of course there's a rich history and tradition of Americans before us struggling for the core issues of democracy. But bluntly, in this generation, we need to look to the global south, to Africa, to other parts of the world where there is a self-identified, self-aware democracy movement taking shape. And as Americans, we need to approach that with a certain degree of humility, and an open heart and an open mind so that we can learn from these other peoples who have actually come a lot further than we have. Since democracy is the issue, let's start with the definition. Democracy, to break it down to the Greek, it's simple. Demosocracy, the people rule, rule by the people. I like it so far. However, few would argue today, at least with a straight face, that the United States of America experiences rule by the people. To rule means literally creating the society that you want to live in. It means constructing the institutions. It means meaningfully engaging and participating in the whole shebang. It does not mean choosing between one corporate-funded candidate versus another corporate-funded candidate. It does not mean Coke or Pepsi. Rule is that. Sovereignty. Who's in charge? And so I guess I'll start by saying corporations do not merely exercise power in this country or on this globe. Corporations rule us. Corporations are ruling us as surely as kings once ruled their subjects in another era, as surely as masters once ruled their bonded slaves. Today, unelected and unaccountable corporate CEOs are making the fundamental public policy decisions of this country. We the people have been reduced from a self-governing sovereign citizen to consumers. Workers at best, allowed to choose between paper or plastic at the grocery store, while the fundamental public policy decisions are being made for us. So how did it come to this? I mean, we the people are hallowed worlds in the United States of America. Aren't we a democracy? I mean, that's what we're taught, right? Our earliest days as children, we're taught that this is a democracy where we the people rule, that we're the great shining example for the rest of the world. And certainly we're told in propaganda, otherwise known as corporate media, that U.S. soldiers are across the world now fighting for democracy for other places. The reality is that we don't have democracy in this country. The reality is we have rule by corporations. So the next stage is to ask ourselves, well, just what is this thing called a corporation, the institution itself, and how did it come to be the dominant institution of our times and of our culture? So very quickly, without going into the deep history of the corporation, let's just start with the word, as we did with democracy, meaning the people rule, the word corporation. Now, so the word incorporate comes from Latin, to give body to, and it suggests that we should look at the first Roman corporations to really get a sense of this entity. And in fact, the first Roman corporations, the ones that we would be most familiar with, include the entity that was constructed to build the famous Colosseum. The first hospitals of the Roman Empire were built by corporations. The schools were built by corporations, and actually not only built by corporations, but were in fact operated by corporations, and the roads. The famous adage, all roads lead to Rome, those roads were built and maintained by corporations. Now, looking at our major topics, I hope that those different institutions, those different corporate forms, those different corporate duties that I've described, something jumps out at you. They're all public. The reality is that in a very real way, the Roman corporations were public entities. Now, the modern transnational corporation doesn't look very much like that, of course. The modern transnational corporation actually has its roots in more recent times, and that is through the Corporate Crown Charter, or otherwise known as the Age of Discovery. Now, I have to put Age of Discovery in quotations, right? Because the Age of Discovery was not discovery. The Age of Discovery was more honestly and accurately described the age of brutal conquest, rape, torture and devastation. That's what that age was. Because when white folks left from Europe to Africa and North and South America and later Asia, there were people already living there, and those people were not lost. Those people did not need to be discovered. Those people had rich, vibrant civilizations that were working to fulfill their needs, and many of them, we might point out, were actually much more efficient, certainly more humane and compassionate institutions than anything that was in existence in Europe at the time of the Age of Discovery. So forgive me if it doesn't gall the hell out of me when I hear people talk about the Age of Discovery when they really are talking about the Age of Brutal Colonial Conquest. So how did it come about? Where did the corporation come from? The reality is that the corporation, the modern transnational corporation, was literally created as an instrument of that brutal conquest. How? Why? Well, because even the king, the sovereign at the time, did not usually have sufficient resources to actually, as the ruler of the nation, to engage in sufficient conquest to vacuum out all of the resources of these new lands. So new entities were created, such as the East India Company, such as the Company of Merchants and Adventurers, which was the ancestor of the East India Company. These crown corporations were created by a charter from the king. And imagine this. Under law at the time, there was a doctrine called inherited debt. And inherited debt means exactly what it sounds like. A man's debts must be paid. And if he does not pay his debts, then those debts will be inherited by his son. And his son will become responsible for paying them. And if he does not pay them, then his son will become responsible. And this will continue until the debts are paid or until one of the progenitors are put into jail. So these folks sat on the right side of the room, so they get to be the aristocrats, the aristocracy, the moneyed interest. And I say, okay, folks, put up all your money. We're going to together create a new instrument. We're going to go out and brutally exploit the rest of the world. And you have the chance, the possibility of getting rich beyond the dreams of avarice. So come on, boys, off to exploitation. And they say, wait a minute, sounds good, but inherited debt. This whole problem, because think about it. One ship lost at sea, one pirate raid, all the money that it takes to actually build the infrastructure for colonial conquest and so forth, from the armies that are raised to the docks that must be built in these other lands and so forth. Any of these things, if it goes badly, could cause enormous financial problems even for these wealthy elite. So I say, as the sovereign, because they sat on the right side of the room, but I'm at the front of the class, so I get to be the king. And as the king, I say, I can solve your problem of inherited debt. We're going to create this new entity called the corporation, a corporate crown charter. How? Because I'm just going to sign a piece of paper, because I'm the king. I create this thing, and I'm going to say this new entity that we just created, called the Company of Merchants and Adventurers, later to be known as the East India Company, is immune from inherited debt. The rest of you schmucks in Europe will still have to deal with inherited debt as a doctrine. However, these special folks get this special compensation, this special dispensation, this new thing called the corporation. And with that, we're going to say they're not responsible for anything other than the initial amount of money that they put up. And now we're going to go out and suck out the resources from the rest of the world. Pretty good gig, right? So that is, in fact, the birth of the modern transnational corporation. These companies rule the European colonies, including the Americas, in the name of the sovereign. They are a quasi-public, quasi-private entity, which is a really interesting shift, right? In other words, created in a really unholy alliance of sort of public-private thing, because the king is acting as the public always, as the sovereign, pooling private resources in order to go out and vacuum out resources from the rest of the world. In addition, the corporations were initially used literally to limit competition, to ensure that the aristocrats did not unfairly compete with one another, or that any of these bourgeois middle-class folks that are beginning to emerge are able to actually make a legitimate claim on international trade. And beyond that, If you take a look at the letters from some of the original governors of the East India Company, which is telling as well, right? I mean, it's a colony. It is a private corporation called the East India Company, but the title is governor. They govern. And it's interesting because there are literally letters writing back to the shareholders, who, by the way, were almost all members of parliament. Things that make you go, So in these letters from India, they literally write back and say, we have a problem here. Because in Africa, in Asia, in some of these other parts, they were simply heathens. And we just conquered them militarily and took their resources. The difference is in India, the civilization looked almost exactly like European civilization, right? So they could not pretend like it wasn't. In fact, they acknowledge very specifically. So in India, the governors of the East India Company write back to the shareholders and say, in order to successfully accomplish our mission, we must not only conquer these people militarily, but we must conquer their existing civilization. We must destroy their existing civilization, their existing cultures, their existing institutions, and replace them with proper English institutions and cultures. We must make them dependent upon us for their very social relationships. That's literally the honesty with which the governors were writing back. So the crown charters of Europe colonize, they vacuum resources, they replace independence with dependence, they eradicate people's sense of their own histories, they eradicate people's memory of their own histories, their own knowledge about what they were capable of and, in fact, what they did before the conqueror and the colonizer came. They begin to define people as subjects, as objects, as property, as invisible. And ultimately, the corporation is the place where all disputes are resolved. And these corporations, the crown corporations, the beginning of the transnational corporation, is literally given the ability to raise armies. And did you know that the East India Corporation had a larger standing army than the British Empire regular soldiers? Stunning. The degree to which these initial corporations had military might, had political legitimacy, we put in quotation marks, that they were instruments, they were able to literally write laws which legalized and instituted the corporation's destructive and dominating acts. And they had the power to enforce the laws and impose punishments, including execution, all under the rubric of the corporation. Now, that's the context for the modern transnational corporation. So frankly, today, when the modern transnational corporation is exploiting the planet and plundering the earth and heading us, hurtling us on this suicide death march, I say, I'm not surprised. That's what it's supposed to do. It's designed to do that. Of course it does that. What I'm surprised about is why the hell we're letting it happen. That's what surprises me. But back to the story. So now we are 13th, 14th, 15th century Europe. We now have a handle on what the corporation is, where it came from. Now let's short circuit to North America, 1600s, 1700s. I like to say that the American revolutionaries were not calling for a more socially responsible king. Because, folks, if you read the Declaration of Independence, which I encourage you all to do, it starts with some beautiful words. When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands that have heretofore connected them to another. And then it goes on to that the famous line, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men, which we will read people, are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, right? Now, that's the part that we're famous that's famous to most Americans, but here's something funny. That's actually a short part of the Declaration. Most of the Declaration is a list of grievances against King George, and not George Bush, King George, the earlier tyrant, the earlier one, King George III, And here's something really interesting. If you read grievance by grievance, specific by specific, what you find is most of those grievances are because the king has allowed conduct to take place. What conduct? Why, the conduct that are being done by the governors. What governors? Why, the corporate governors, meaning the CEOs of their day. Whether it's the housing of standing armies, suspending writ of habeas corpus, I mean, all of the various grievances, virtually every one of them, can be directly tied back to the corporate governors or the corporations. Folks, the United States Revolution was not merely a rejection of monarchy as a form of government, as powerful and profound as that was. It was, in fact, in addition to a people's uprising against illegitimate corporate rule. We are in good company. That's what the American Revolution was really about. And so the idea was not that they weren't going to simply negotiate with the king, asking for a little less harm or rule a little nicer. They uprooted the idea of the monarchy and that of a foreign sovereign. Now, I think it's important also to really, like I said, what happened in that time period? Well, a lot of things are happening, right? And we won't know all of the things that were happening because ordinary people were having meetings like this, right? I mean, I think that's important to understand that for so many, whether it was called the committees of correspondence or anything else, ordinary people who were farmers and merchants and mechanics were having conversations with one another, grappling with these kind of issues. But one thing that we do know that happened that was huge was the publication of a pamphlet called Common Sense. It was in January of 1776, a full 6 months before the Declaration of Independence was signed, and Thomas Paine sought to transform a growing protest into outright rebellion. The colonists generally viewed themselves as, at the time, up until that point, they continued to view themselves as English subjects fighting a tyrannical king, to be sure, but fighting to be treated more like English subjects of the king, right? That was the original clashes. And for all their anger, most colonists were protesting the king and parliament for disregarding the rights that were guaranteed under what is called England's unwritten constitution. They were certainly not challenging the king or governmental legitimacy, at least at that time. Thomas Paine did something profound, because he rejected not only King George III, but Thomas Paine rejected the entire British system itself as inherently oppressive and prodded his readers to establish their own country, their own nation. Common Sense was, in fact, successful, and by the spring of 1776, newspapers were reporting on the number of converts to the idea of independence, including, literally, quote, tens of thousands of common farmers and tradesmen were flocking to this idea. Paine called with a burning sense of urgency for the colonies to simply break away from Britain, but he also started by persuading the readers of that pamphlet that the source of the colonists' problems went beyond corrupt or abusive English government to the very structure of rule by hereditary kings and nobility. Instead of treating the monarchy with the customary deference that was usual in writings and speeches of the day, Paine openly declared that the founder of the current line of reign, William the Conqueror, and I'm going to quote from Common Sense. William the Conqueror is a French bastard who landed with a group of armed bandits and established himself King of England against the consent of Englishmen. End quote. He ridiculed nobility, not just the king, but nobility itself, declaring nobles, and I'm going to quote again, frequently the most ignorant and unfit of any throughout all the globe. End quote. Frankly, maybe we ought to start asking ourselves the same thing about not only George Bush, but about corporate America themselves. Who are these idiots who are driving us over the precipice? Who are these idiots who are allowing our healthcare choices to be made as a profit where most people don't actually have access to healthcare? Why the hell are these idiots in charge? And I don't want to be too ugly and mean about it because at the end of the day, frankly, I think these people are mentally ill. And if I were being more charitable and more compassionate, I would say, why aren't we getting these people the help that they need? But I would also say this, why the hell are we putting them in charge? Now, the American Revolution, of course, rejected monarchy as a form of government. It's a people's uprising, And I wish that we had time to go into the Articles of Confederation, but I would urge you, please go back and look at that rich history based on the Iroquois Confederation, an idea where I would actually suggest real democratic spirits were unleashed in the United States of America during that time period after the American Revolution and before the creation of the Constitution in 1787. That's a place where more research, more study, more conversation amongst radical Democrats of the day should take place. But for the purpose of what the corporation is, let's look at the U.S. Constitution. Now, the United States Constitution is really, as a document, can be looked at almost as a dichotomy. In the U.S. Constitution, you have we the people, and you have government. And it's really interesting and worth pointing out that according to this doctrine, and what I'm going to do now is what I will base, I'll call this an introduction to American political theory, not practice, but American political theory. In the U.S. Constitution, all legitimate power now resides in the people. A certain amount of power or authority is delegated to this institution known as government. Why? Well, in order to do certain things that we want done in our names and for us. We, the people, are the source of all legitimate power. Our rights are individual political and civil rights, bless you. They are not granted to us because of that document. They are recognized by that document, but those rights that you have as a human being are because you exist. Because the goddess created you, from that very moment, you actually now have political and civil rights. Government only has duties. Duties to do what? Why, to do the things that they're delegated to do. And I think it's important to understand when you read the U.S. constitutional framework, the line between we the people and government is profound. And we the people have rights, government has duties, and in fact, if you look back to English common law, the very definition of law itself is a function between the interchange between rights and duties. And I would say, never or certainly rarely does government ever have any fundamental rights over the people, and never do the people have absolute duties to government as an institution. They may have moral duties to one another, but in terms of duties that they can be compelled to serve the instrument known as the state, it doesn't exist under this framework. We the people have rights, government has duties, government does not have rights over the people do not have duties over government. It's capturing the idea that we the people are free and sovereign. We rule, we have the power. Government is subordinate and accountable. Subordinate and accountable to who? To we the people. And another way to think about this is that this is the private, and that is the public sphere. And looking at this constitutional framework, I say, that's brilliant. I love this as a concept. I mean, because it captures my civil libertarian impulses about my ability to do what I want, to say what I want within my private framework, but it also recognizes that I and you and all of us are part of a public community, that we have a manner and a mechanism by which we collectively have to come together and make some decisions. That's brilliant. We should try that in this country. I think it might work. As beautiful as this is, when was the U.S. Constitution ratified? 1787? Drafted in 1787, ultimately ratified in 1789, but there it is. Trick question, but most of you got it. So 1787 to 1789. So at that time, who are the people? Is it all the human beings living? No. Say it again. White, male, property owned, and Christian. And if we really want to get down to it, of a certain age, right? So there is, in the founding of this country, there is a profound violence against women, against all people of color, against the indigenous people who were being slaughtered, certainly against the Africans who were brought here in chains as slaves. So the founding of this country is a founding violence that echoes and reverberates to this day. And it is, that echo is seen in the racism and the sexism and the classism and all of the other roots of oppression that continue to exist in this country. So although this framework is beautiful, the reality is we have never lived up to the promise of democracy in the United States of America. We've not even really come close, because from its very founding, there was, most human beings were not legally persons. Why? Because remember, legal personhood means that you have rights that you can assert, and that if somebody else offends your rights, that you can go into court if necessary and have your rights respected, and that the government, even with armed force, will be willing to come in if necessary to protect your rights. And in fact, let's just be candid, the entire history of the United States of America in one manner can literally be viewed and described as a series of pitched struggles by other human beings to be defined as persons under the Constitution. So it's an ongoing struggle, and there have been moments of more democratic spirit unleashed and advances made. I think it's also important for us to take a quick handle on, immediately after the American Revolution, there were still corporations that existed. But at that time then, after the American Revolution, there was the corporation as an instrument was not really used to carry out the racism and the sexism and so forth. Corporation as an instrument was actually very tightly controlled by that small group of elite men who were ruling at the time, the people that got to be really people. It gets really difficult to keep all these thoughts in your head at one time. But the reality is that the corporation was tightly controlled. Why? Because these were people who had just fought a brutal, bloody war to kick out one corporate oppressor, and they didn't want to see another one. But they still allowed corporations to exist. But what was really interesting is that they understood that it was a great privilege, not a right, but a great privilege to be able to incorporate and have this quasi-public, quasi-private entity. And as a result, they made it very difficult to even get the corporate privilege. In fact, so difficult, do you know what it took to actually incorporate? You had to have an act of the state legislature. And of course, at that time, every state legislature had two different branches, right? So you had to have both branches of the state legislature pass an act. Then it had to go to the governor, who then signed it, to even get it. And every single one, and that was, so what, that was the chartering process. And every single one of those had incredible restrictions and controls on what a corporation was or was not. For example, corporations licensed to do business were revocable by state legislature if they exceeded or did not fulfill the chartered purpose. The chartered purpose had to be very strictly defined and described. The state legislature could revoke a corporate charter for any reason, any particular reason, or no reason at all. Again, a privilege, not a right. The act of incorporation did not relieve corporate management or the stockholders or the owners of responsibility or liability for corporate acts. As a matter of course, corporate officers, directors, and agents could usually be held criminally liable for any conduct on that the corporation actually did. State, not federal courts, heard the cases where corporations or their agents were accused of breaking the law, again, because they were closer to the people. Directors of the corporation were required to actually come from the stockholders or the shareholders. You couldn't have these sort of like these interlocking directorates. Corporations had to have their headquarters and meetings in the state where their principal place of business was located. Here's something great. Corporate charters were granted for a very specific period of time, usually 10 to 20 years, instead of being granted in perpetuity. And every 20 years, it meant the corporation had to go back to the state legislature and back to the governor to ask all over again for the right to exist. Corporations' real estate holdings were limited to what was actually necessary to carry out whatever their specific chartered purpose was. Corporations were prohibited as an absolute matter of law from making any political contributions, direct or indirect. Yeah. Corporations were prohibited from making charitable or civic donations outside of their specific purpose. No buying us off the way the transnationals do today. State legislators set the rates that corporations could charge for their products. Many times, in fact, if it was for a turnpike or a road or a canal, it would start off as a private corporation, and then after they made a certain amount of what was considered fair profit, then, by definition, that road, that tollway, that canal reverted to public ownership. All corporate records and documents were open to the legislature or to the state attorney general at any time. And I saved the best for last, the coup de grace, as Bugs Bunny would say. Corporations were required to have a clear and specific public purpose. A corporation was not allowed under law to be merely a private entity. In fact, if their purpose was merely private selfish gain, they were not entitled to the privilege of incorporation. Now, certainly they could do that kind of business as a person, as a business person, but the charter, the privileges associated with a charter to be able to pool money in that specific way as a public entity could not be held. In other words, the corporation, properly understood at this time, and I would say if we really understood the corporate entity, because its charter specifically defined its duty, because its charter came from the government, the state legislature, who was acting as our elected representatives, because it was always subordinate and accountable to its creator, the state legislature, who could revoke it at any time. Anybody can easily, if I'm right about this line, about this dichotomy between the people and government, rights and duties, free and sovereign, subordinate and accountable, if I'm right about this, which I am, if I'm right about all of this, then the corporation, properly understood, must be on this side of the line. It's the only way the American political experiment can actually function, is to keep this entity on this side of the line. So, the corporation, properly understood, is a public entity. It should be a public entity under strict control. However, from the very beginning, there was a pitched battle between the democratic spirit that had been unleashed and the ruling elites of their day. So much so that Thomas Jefferson himself wrote about the corporations in the early 1800s, only a few decades after the ratification of the United States Constitution. And he wrote, "I hope we shall crush in its birth the aristocracy of our moneyed corporations, which dare already to challenge our government to a trial of strength and bid defiance to the laws of our country." From the very beginning. And I want to be clear about this. The U.S. constitutional framework, as described and defined, I think is a brilliant idea. The reality is, it's never from its very inception been democratic. It's never from its very inception or practice been anything other than a document to protect the ruling elite and their property. We had very tight controls over the corporation for some period of time in the United States history. What happened? Well, we saw already that the elites were going into their state legislatures and trying to undermine them. And we also had the birth of a whole new era of law in the United States of America. It's called regulatory law. And in fact, the nation's first regulatory agency is the Interstate Commerce Commission, which was itself established in 1887, roughly 100 years after the Constitution. And I'll be very candid with you. I remember in high school being taught that this era was one of the great spirits of reform and of the people fighting back, and that the Interstate Commerce Commission was an example of a great move forward for the people. And that's what I believed. So, and I was taught that concerned citizens, having failed to solve their difficulties in more traditional ways, sought the intervention and assistance of the federal government. And over the next three decades, the Mavericks worked to defend the Interstate Commerce Commission's existence and to increase its ability to regulate the corporations of its days, most specifically the railroads, which were the mightiest of the corporations of the day. So I'll ask you, who were the pioneers who dared to go where no one had gone before? Who were these people who urged the formation of and demanded the expansion of powers of these first regulatory agencies? The answer? The robber baron railroad corporations themselves were the actual proponents. Prominent amongst the original proponents of the Interstate Commerce Commission was none other than Vanderbilt himself, We also had Charles Adams, who was president of the Minnesota and Northwest Railroad Company. You had A.B. Stickney, the director of the Chicago, Burlington, and Quincy Railroad Company. There's a list of about a dozen different men, all of whom were presidents or vice presidents or otherwise managers of the railroad corporations. You also had a proponent known as J.P. Morgan, the banker associated with the rise of the International Harvester Company and U.S. Steel. And you also, so the point I'm making is, it was the corporate elite who actually behind the scenes were agitating for the creation of the Interstate Commerce Commission. Now, the question then it begs is, why? I mean, what's up with that? The reality is that late 19th century railroad companies were actually being troubled by competition. There were waves of fierce rate wars. They were undercutting one another. You know, competition, the thing that the right loves to talk about all the time. They were using a form of rebates, which was really a bribe, used by rival companies to steal each other's customers. It was leading to major bankruptcies. So corporate mergers, trust, trade associations were all methods that had been used by corporations in an effort to eliminate competition. Each one, however, found problems by populist state legislators who actually recognized that they were supposed to be representing the people's interests rather than corporate interests. Until the late 1800s, for example, most mergers were effectively illegal, and because most states actually had laws, as I said, that prohibited corporations from owning stock in any other corporation. Trusts, which were an effort to finesse around this, were made at least technically illegal by the 1890 Sherman Antitrust Act, which, of course, as we know, from its very beginning, was subject to, at best, spotty enforcement, and soon was rendered virtually useless by judicial interpretations that completely gutted what it actually says. So the associations then tried to control the market by means of informal price agreements, standards, and licenses, but they all ultimately failed for two reasons. One, they didn't have the force of law, and two, competition continued to happen. In other words, there was no honor amongst the thieves of the corporate managers because they'd make an agreement on prices, and then one would undercut the other one as soon as the ink was dry. So railroad companies wanted to fix rates amongst themselves and then enforce the rates. That is, they legally wanted legally enforceable price fixing in the name of competition. They wanted wanted the shield against the tide of public activism that was showing itself and manifesting in very tough new state laws. Increased populism, calls for government ownership of railroads and all public utilities, and the great flowering known as the populist uprising, which we should say found, I think, its greatest political expression in a political party, an alternative political party, alternative to the two establishment parties, called the People's Party or the Populist Party. Now, and at the same time, there is a resurgence, or really this sort of flowering in this country, of a full-on red socialist movement in this country. And so there were all these various threads, but at their core, all of them shared in common a recognition that the small elite who were concentrating ever more economic wealth, power, and decision-making authority was illegitimate and unjust and needed to be tackled head-on. So the railroad barons of their day came up with this notion of the Interstate Commerce Commission in order to undermine and delegitimize all of these things. In fact, I want to read to you what A.B. Stickney of the Chicago and Great Western Railroad Company explained about the Interstate Commerce Commission and their rates. Stickney wrote, "Let the law name the rates, and then let the law maintain them to protect their integrity." He expressed a confident hope to his fellow robber barons that, quote, "The law will go ahead and catch every law-breaking rate cutter in the country." A railroad man later wrote to the Interstate Commerce Commission in 1897, "O Lord, pity us in Nebraska and preserve us from the results of a populist legislature and state government." President Cleveland's Attorney General, Richard Olney at the time, explained to railroad corporation executives in a letter that the ICC, the Interstate Commerce Commission, is, I quote, "going to be merely a sort of barrier between the railroad corporations and the people themselves." So from the very early days of the Interstate Commerce Commission, They saw that what was needed to solve the Railroad Corporation's problem, and I'm going to quote again from a letter, this one from Charles Adams, president of the Union Pacific Railroad Company, something that has a good-sounding name but is actually quite harmless to us. Something which will impress the popular mind with the idea that a great deal is being done when in reality very little is intended to be done except that which we want. Regulatory agencies like the Interstate Commerce Commission transform activities that were once illegal, such as price fixing and market control, into practices that are now not only legal, but mandatory. With the government doing the enforcing and taxpayers bearing the infrastructure costs, while business corporations, investors, and speculators reap the profit. That is the creation of the regulatory framework. That is the difference between defining or regulating. Any environmentalist worth her or his salt can tell you what environmental regulatory agencies regulate. Answer? Environmentalists. The reality is that they recognize that that their real clients are the industries that they purport to regulate. And I want to be very clear in Canada about this. There are good and noble women and men laboring mightily within the regulatory agencies, but the system is designed to prevent them from actually doing any real good. So that was the attack at the statutory level. And as if that wasn't bad enough, it goes into the courts. And this brings us now, remember the American Civil War, right? So you had basically absolute disarray and disruption of the social fabric. I mean, there was utter and complete chaos. And, of course, the elites took advantage of this chaos and immediately go into the state legislatures and begin bribing their legislatures. And even our propagandized U.S. history textbooks from high school describe this as the age of the robber barons, where legislation was bought and paid for. And one by one, the railroad barons and the corporate elite began buying off all of those restrictions that we had described earlier. One by one, beginning to strip them away. But that wasn't enough. They had to ultimately go into the courts. And whenever they went into the courts, they began to attack the very framework of the United States Constitution. And it was then, and let's be clear, after the Civil War, the great amendments to the Constitution, the 13th Amendment abolishes slavery, period, unquestionable. The 14th Amendment says specifically, no person shall be denied equal protection or due process of the law. Now, so these so-called Civil War amendments are basically to abolish the institution of slavery and to make it clear that black men, at least, are going to be persons under the law. Now, it's interesting because the 14th Amendment, when it's adopted, and this language it says no person shall be denied equal protection or due process of the law, there was one group of human persons that were very excited about that. It was a group of women who said, no person shall be denied due process or equal protection of the laws. In other words, you can't have a law that discriminates. Well, we think that all these state laws that prohibit us as women from voting, we think that that actually is a violation now of the U.S. Constitution, since the 14th Amendment is part of the Constitution. It becomes part of that document. Makes sense, right? Women are persons under law. The laws are denying them equal protection. Of course they're right. Answer, the United States Supreme Court said no. Women, in Minor versus Happersett, the court writes, are not persons as contemplated by the 14th Amendment. So the 14th Amendment does not apply, and all of those state laws forbidding women from voting are in fact constitutionally accepted, even under the 14th Amendment. And just a short decade later, the corporations go into the courts and say, well, we are persons because all these laws that are attempting to control our conduct are actually violations of our constitutional rights. After all, a corporation is just a group of people who have come together, right? And so when we come together and pool our resources, then the entity we created called the corporation actually should have rights as well. We have them individually, so now collectively this entity does. And the courts actually reject this time and time again until ultimately they prevail. And the court says that a corporation is not a public entity, but is instead to be treated as a private person under law with certain rights that must be respected. And folks, the idea of legal personhood being applied to the Constitution fundamentally perverts the entire American political framework. It makes the continued experiment of American democracy impossible. It ultimately perverts whatever sense that we have of perfecting and improving upon it. And let's be very clear about this. It makes economic democracy off the table. You might tinker at the margins about society, but economics are now utterly and completely private affairs. It was fought mightily by not just ordinary citizens, but by lawyers, by judges. You had a full-on uprising in the legal community around the idea that a corporation was a person vested with constitutional rights. When that decision came forward, there were calls for state constitutional conventions to correct the grievous error that had been made. The clear usurpation of the courts to strip persons of their ability, our elected representatives, strip them of the ability to actually create and control economics and to denude populist legislatures and to empower the corporation. Because when a corporation, understand this, when a corporation goes into court to claim that their rights are being violated, what they're saying is that some law at the local, state, or federal level that attempts to control their conduct and is attempting to prevent them from causing harm or abuse to a community, to a group of people, or to an ecosystem, that control that is illegal, that it is unconstitutional, that we the people don't have the right because their political or civil liberties are somehow being violated. So the whole idea that a corporation, which is at its nature nothing more than an idea of concentrating capital and money, can have rights is perverse. It is insane. And I guess the point that I'm really trying to drive home is that this is a ridiculous idea that was shoved down people's throats by judges. Judges who are not elected, judges who are not really accountable to anybody. And the fact that we accept this somehow is really perverse. And I am, in fact, calling not only to delegitimize the notion of corporate personhood or corporate constitutional rights. Ultimately, I'm saying, what the hell are we doing saying that nine men get to tell us what our Constitution says? Why do we really expect that nine judges in robes can somehow be the ultimate supreme authority for the parameters of our Constitution and of our very essence of our government? Because after all, this is the same institution that brought us the Dred Scott decision. And what did this noble institution tell us in Dred Scott? Why, that a black man was nothing more than property and had no rights that any white man that was bound to ever uphold or respect. This Supreme Court is the same institution that gave us Plessy versus Ferguson, that said, of course all these Jim Crow segregation laws of separate but equal are perfectly acceptable and constitutional. This is the same institution, the Supreme Court, that gave us Minor versus Happersett, that said women are not people. This is the same Supreme Court, I might point out, that gave us Bush versus Gore and installed an unelected president into the White House. Right? So I think it's important for us to understand, if we're really going to grapple with a democracy movement, at the end of the day, we really have to grapple with the fact that our social, political, and economic institutions have been literally hijacked from us. And we cannot allow ourselves to stay only in the regulatory framework and the regulatory box. Absolutely, we have to do that work. I've litigated in those regulatory frameworks. I've protested within them. I certainly work within the regulatory framework. But that's not the only place I do my work. I'm proud to say I've been to jail for justice. I'm proud to say that I'm prepared to go to jail for justice again. I definitely engage in nonviolent civil disobedience. And as Samuel Gomper said, history honors none above those who violate unjust laws. And as a lawyer, let me look right into the camera and say, I encourage citizens across the United States of America to also join me in violating unjust laws. That's the kind of mentality that we've got to get into. Because we have unjust laws that are destroying our planet. We have an unjust system that is hurtling us to oblivion. And it's not just that, but we literally have got to understand and that we cannot allow judges to describe to us what the parameters are about what we can or cannot do. So I sort of stopped at this moment. We could go even further into even greater detail about how corporations continue to go into courts and one by one get ever more ability to claim constitutional rights and protections. The First Amendment, the Fourth Amendment, on and on and on and on, to the point where it's hard for us, as Cornel West says, to even imagine what a really free and democratic society might look like. It's hard for us to even imagine. And so I guess I'll conclude my remarks by saying, let's start to engage our civic imagination and try to imagine what it might be like if we were to create ourselves a democratic, just, and compassionate society in the United States of America.
You've been listening to David Cobb, public interest lawyer from Texas and former Green Party presidential candidate. He was speaking at the 2006 Green Institute Conference in Washington, D.C. If you'd like to download an MP3 of this and all previous shows, they're all online at the archive at unwelcomeguests.org. As always, I encourage you to make copies and distribute this show to anyone you think might be willing to listen. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening.
The rangers and deputies are hired by the rich man to catch me and hang me, my shiny black. Catch me napping one day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end. For my guns and my saddle.